This is The Guardian.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Science Weekly is supported by Rainforest Trust. In honor of this year's Earth Day, we're promoting Rainforest Trust's Brazilian Amazon Fund throughout April. Rainforest Trust is a 501c3 organization, which means that 100% of all money donated goes directly to conservation efforts. The fund has already helped protect more than 6.5 million acres of rainforest habitat, but Rainforest Trust still needs to protect a further 13 million acres to reach its goal. You can help. Donate online at rainforesttrust.org/earthday this April, and your generous gift will be quadruple matched for the Brazilian Amazon.
The internet is a challenging place for young people to navigate. There's games, friendship, shopping, places to learn and be creative. But it's also a total minefield. There's bullying, addiction, misinformation, and dangerous ideologies that can cause real-life harm. As the UK's Online Safety Bill is being finalised, a group of Conservative peers have said that it needs tougher rules to target misogyny, something that increasing numbers of children are exposed to online through pornography and videos from influencers like Andrew Tate.
Demasculinization of men is a genuine plague we are suffering with in the West.
Bang out the machete, boom in her face, and then grip her up by the neck.
So today on Science Weekly, we're taking a dive into this difficult topic. We're asking, what makes young people vulnerable to this kind of content? And how does it affect their brains and behaviour? From The Guardian, I'm Madeline Finlay, and this is Science Weekly. Sally Wheel, you're The Guardian's education correspondent, and recently you wrote about the report by the Children's Commissioner for England looking at the rise in children watching pornography online. So for anyone who didn't hear about this at the time, perhaps you could give me some of the headline findings of this report.
It was, as you say, a report by the Children's Commissioner for England, Dame Rachel D'Souza, who used to be a head teacher and has come across these issues, you know, in schools for some years now and has kind of made it a priority. So this report was all about pornography. And I think everyone's known, it's become increasingly clear that very young children even are looking at pornography. One of the findings was that I think 1 in 10 children under the age of 9 had seen porn. About a quarter of children in their sort of final year of primary school, so you're talking 11, a quarter of them had seen porn. 4 out of 5 of the young people who took part in the survey said that they'd seen porn involving violence by the age of 18.
And one of the things that shocked me as well was that 1 in 3 young people who had done this survey had actively sought out the depictions of sexual violence. And this is coming at a time when there's been concern anyway about the impact of online misogyny on people. So tell me what you've been hearing from parents and schools. How has this become a growing problem?
Porn has become an absolutely massive issue. I mean, I've been covering education and thinking about sex education for about 8 years now. And it has got bigger and bigger. The porn industry has become massive, and it's very hard, I think, for kids to actually avoid it online. I've been looking particularly at sort of Andrew Tate and the kind of appeal of somebody like him, a social influencer with absolutely massive following, kids watching porn and then finding themselves being interested in somebody like Andrew Tate. It's a sort of fairly kind of worrying combination.
So for anyone who hasn't heard of Andrew Tate, he's a social media influencer and self-described misogynist, and his videos portray a kind of hyper-toxic masculinity. You've got the cars, the cigars, the guns, this seemingly luxurious lifestyle. And Tate himself is kind of charismatic. He's seemingly very successful. He's rich. He's muscly. And his videos have been watched billions of times. But a big part of his personality is his extreme views about violence and about women. So what impact have you heard this having in schools and at home?
We're only starting to pick up on this a bit last year. And it's kind of just Tate-style comments and little sayings like, you know, make me a sandwich, little phrases, you know, used to just sort of humiliate women and send them back to the kitchen and so on. And then I think sort of it's become a much bigger deal. I mean, I was talking to a teacher friend yesterday who said, you know, his school has just started addressing it. And the teachers were all asked, you know, how many of you have had sort of Andrew Tate raised as an issue in the classroom? So over half of them put up their hands. I think there's a feeling that some young people, some young men have challenging behaviour towards female teachers, not obeying instructions from female teachers, misogynistic comments to teachers. And in terms of kind of pupils, slightly more nuanced, but one head teacher said she kind of perceived that there was a growing need among boys to kind of control girls. They'd seen one incident where you know, a boy kind of pinned a girl against a wall with her kind of shoulder around her neck and shoulder. And then another kind of incident where a boy wanted to confiscate his girlfriend's phone so that she was cut off and she couldn't make calls. And it's this kind of weird, sort of worrying, controlling aspect, which I think teachers are kind of linking to the sort of content that children are seeing online.
Why is this kind of content having such a big impact on the kids who are watching it? For that, you probably need to understand what's happening in the brain at this age.
This is what we would call a developmentally time-critical sensitive period. There are changes happening from around the age of 9 going up into the teens that are quite sort of unique.
That's Dr. Dickon Bevington, an NHS consultant, child and adolescent psychiatrist, and medical director for the Anna Freud National Centre for Children and Families, a charity that provides support and training for child mental health services.
Broadly, there's a sort of network across our brain that gets described as the social information processing network. And it kind of has three main components that all mature at different speeds. The first of those components, the threat, arousal, response, survival part of the brain, that's pretty much up and running in a newborn infant. Then through primary school years, around the age of 9, 10, 11, you have another set of capacities. And these are the parts of the brain that not only do sort of things like language, they also seem to be where the child starts to, if you like, create a set of almost like scripts about how people should or ought to kind of behave in certain contexts. Most parents would recognise that something quite dramatic begins to shift and their child becomes significantly more socially aware that there are ways of doing things that are okay and there are ways that are doing things that are distinctly uncool. At that point, what they don't have is, if you like, the final bit of the triad, the braking system, this prefrontal cortex that really only reaches adult shape by about the age of 24, 25. And it's these fundamental patterns that are being laid down in our brains
That's the context. And so I asked Dickon what it means for children exposed to pornography and misogynistic content.
There are two things going on at the same time that I would say need to be thought about. One is, as we've said, this sponge-like quality for young people around trying to learn the rules. And if the rules are kind of being demonstrated by an Andrew Tate-like character or one of his clones, that is going to be absorbed.
The second issue with watching online pornography at this age is that alongside many other emotions, it's arousing.
Because of this arousal, there are parallels between the way the brain responds to that to the way it responds to any other pleasurable experiences. The first time a child is introduced to chocolate, it creates a nice warm rush, bit of dopamine, to be rather crude about the whole thing. And if you like, that starts to lay down a pathway in a child's brain that sugary substances, generally speaking, in a predictable way, induce a certain feeling that is one that I'll go for again. And there are elements of the excitement, the arousal, and as they become more aware of what it is they're watching, the sexual excitement that is very similar to what happens with other substances, alcohol, cannabis, and all the other drugs. That I'm not saying these are exactly the same, but there's certainly one or two studies that are hinting that there are some parallels.
In essence, kids may be learning that pornography, and in many cases violent pornography, is going to give them a hit of dopamine. But this is a particular concern for vulnerable children.
There are, I'm sure, plenty of young people who have seen plenty of things, but because other things in their life, other relationships, levels of support, internal kind of robustness for whatever reason is sufficient, that they would say, well, I've seen this stuff and it was kind of gave me a bit of a shock, but it's all right. It's the problem is that children that have perhaps experienced already some kind of trauma or loss, some sense that they're untended, those children develop and have a greater, what we call a greater valency for sort of falling into this DIY approach to managing pleasure and dealing with experiences of loss or trauma, so that drugs, alcohol, porn all become elements where, if you like, they treat some other loss or lack by filling it with something that they just know is available and is predictable.
The thing is, what Dickon is describing is a general picture of what's going on, because actually there's been very few studies on the specific impact of pornography. So, Dickon, from your point of view, generally, what can and should we be doing to prevent the negative impacts of children being exposed to this kind of material?
I suppose it sort of boils down to cultural changes about how parents engage with and talk with children and young people, and legislative changes in terms of how we as a society balance our wish for freedoms against the harms that those freedoms can, I think, undoubtedly cause.
Sally, phones aren't going anywhere. Most parents wouldn't dare take their children's phones off them. It's where they live their lives a lot of the time online. And yet pornography, misogyny, it seems like it is everywhere online too. The online safety bill is being finalised, and hopefully that might put some more onus on social media companies to take responsibility for some of these issues. But where do you see this all going?
Yes, the online safety bill, I think, will clearly go some way to addressing it, but I don't think anybody believes it's going to be the whole solution, do they? Yes, it's about tech firms, you know, taking responsibility, you know, to protect young people from harmful material and to kind of enforce age limits, which I think, you know, we all know are largely ignored. But yeah, I think it's got to be a much bigger effort by the government, by schools, to teach about online safety. You know, Rachel D'Souza in that report on porn was saying we have got to act. I mean, she was basically saying in 20 years' time, we are going to be horrified at what we were letting very young children see absorb, you know, online.
Well, Sally, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Dr. Dickon Bevington and to Sally Wheel. If you want to read Sally's coverage of these issues, just head to the podcast webpage at theguardian.com. That's it for today. The producers were me, Madeline Finlay, and Helen Brown. The sound design was by Tony Onochuku. And the executive producer was Ellie Bury. We'll be back on Tuesday. See you then.
This is The Guardian.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.